Okay, look, today I'm in Chelmsford talking to Barry Dennis. Everybody will know from the betting ring and from Channel 4 and from the Sun newspaper. Barry, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us. Can you please start at the beginning and give us a bit of an insight into your beginnings?
Yeah, sure, it's a pleasure. What is the beginnings? Difficult to say. Let's go down this route. That my father passed away just after the Second World War, so I had a stepfather. And he used to give me envelopes to post on the way to school every morning. And I didn't know what that was all about until one day I forgot to post it. And I thought, oh my God. So I opened it up, and inside there was a 5-shilling postal order where he wanted 2 and 6 pence each way, a horse, and it was to McLaughlin's. I don't know how many people of you lot have ever heard of McLaughlin's of Scotland. They accepted postal bets, providing the time was before 10 o'clock on the day of the race. So anyway, he'd lost. I thought, now what do I do? So I fessed up to him, didn't I? I give his 5 shillings back. And I said, I didn't know that was what he was doing. But that gave me the interest of what he was studying for me every night and sending off these envelopes to McLaughlin's, having bets. The same day of the race, guys, remember that, like, you know, we just had, have a postmark before 10 o'clock in the morning. But, so as the big races come along, the Derby or Grand National or anything like that, I took a bigger interest in what he'd backed. So that got me into the game, if you like, that there was gambling the way you could play, and although he was a mug and he lost, I just thought, this is fun, like, you know what I mean? So that was when I was 8 or 9 or 10. Now, talking about I'm 78, that's 70 years ago. So did that start me off in the racing game? Well, when I went to secondary school at the age of 11, a big race come around. I think that was probably the Derby. And there was a geezer named Lester Piggott riding something called Never Say Die. So I told all the kids at school, you see how you have a bet, like, you know, when you have 6 months each way and I'll pay you out when it wins, blah, blah, blah. And they all backed Lester Piggott, 33-1, Never Say Die. I'd done a fortune, hadn't got enough money to pay him, but I had missed school for 2 weeks. So what I did was, I lived in, my address was 53 Market Place, Romford. And I lived above in a flat with my mum, above a cafe. And I used to go down in the market and duck and dive down there when I load the barrows and running the fruit around and the veg from their stores out the back. They used to tip me a few quid. And so consequently, that's where I could earn money during the course of the week out of Romford Market. Just after the war, there was a paper shortage. And a guy used to come around with a lorry every Monday, and he used to buy cardboard and paper off you that was all bundled up. So there I was scavenging amongst all the stalls, picking up paper and tying it all up to sell it to this geezer. So eventually I got enough money to go back to school and pay them all off. They were pleased to see me, I can assure you. So next time a big race come around, a mate of mine, who turned out to be my best man at my wedding, Roy Cook, poor old Cookie, rest in peace, he said, I know a bloke that's got a house down the Brentwood Road in Romford where you can put bets on. I thought, blimey, we'll get into this one. Like, we'll have a hedge next time. We can't keep standing this and having to miss school. So next race come along, went down, knocked on the door, 172 Brentwood Road, Romford. And the guy comes, what do you want? I said, I want to put some bets on, mister. He said, how old are you? I said, well, I'm 12, 13 or something like that. So he says, come in, let's talk. Anyway, long story short, he was Les Carey, who became George Brent. And when betting shops opened in 1961, he was already running this office from his house. He opened up betting shops, and so I became a betting shop manager in 1961. Good stories about, though, with Les Carey. After a while, I used to clean his car. He had a big Humber Super Snipe, big as the house it was, the car. And he used to give me 5 shillings. That's 25 pence, guys, okay? 5 shillings for cleaning it. And I always put the 5 shillings on the first favourite at Park Royal. Every Monday I cleaned the car. I don't think it ever won. Anyway, I then started working for him in the evenings on the phones when he wanted to go out having a drink and take the bets over the phone. So it's obvious that when betting shops were opened in 1961, he opened up one in Romford to kick off with. With inside 12 months, he had 20 betting shops all around the east area of Essex, Barking, Dagenham, and I was working in the betting shop game. And so that's how I really got into racing.
So Barry, when did your when did you first actually start going racing and taking interest in the on-course business?
Well, that happened because after about 5 or 6, 7 years, listen, remember guys, now I'm 78, the years are so long ago, but I hope that I got the right dates. After 6 or 7 years, he sold out to Corals, the George Brent shops, and he retired, went to Greece. Les Carey did, or George Brent is in it. By the way, in between all that, during that period, he was renowned and famous, we were all famous, for the Dagenham Dog Coup. We organised the Dagenham Dog Coup back in 1964. And well, we nearly got a few million pounds, but we didn't get paid. So that's another story. So when he did sell out and retire, 67, Corals took over. Well, it weren't the same terms anymore, and it was all a lot stricter. And I finished up leaving the game then. And I went to work for the Essex Water Company on the 1st of January 1968 as a clerk. I worked there for about a year, and I went to the Epsom Derby as a bookmaker on the one-off day a year, just for the fun of it. And so then I thought, I'll apply for pitches. So I went to the NJPC, National Joint Pitch Council, where you applied and put my name down. And after about a year, they gave me the 4 shilling ring at Brighton. There was 5 rings at Brighton in them days. The 4 shilling ring was opposite the main grandstand. And if you look behind, you could see the sea. But don't walk back too far, because you'd fall over the cliff and finish up in the sea. Anyway, so that was my first ever venture, a 4 shilling ring at Brighton.
Barry, you can't leave it there. You've got to go back to the Dagenham Dog Coup.
Right, well, the Dagenham Dog Coup, let's go to the story. In the office one day, the other officers were ringing up and said, there's people going around having £2 place on the favourite in the first race at Dagenham today. And so all sold all round the shops, he'd got perhaps 100 or 200 quid a place. So he said, come on, Bell. He collected me, Les Carey, and we went over to Dagenham Dogs, went in. And the coup was, they was going to stuff loads of money on the outside and near the off. The market would have been very weak the first race at Dagenham on a Tuesday afternoon. The market would be weak, they're going to stuff loads of money on the outside, they had no chance. So the favourite would probably play 3 or 4 to 1. So Les and I stepped in, he gave me a few quid, and we started backing the favourite for a place. The favourite got placed, paid a less than even money a place. There was some 50 cuffs, knives were drawn, and old Bill arrived, and we was all carted off down the local nick, and none of us were press charged, and it was dropped. So the person that had organised it, John Turner and his mate Reg the Rigger, nice names, isn't they? So they said, you've ruined us, like, you know what I mean? We was going to arrange a big coup. So Les said, what's the big coup? He said, we're going to have a dog forecast coup. He said, when we won enough money. So Les said, come on, I'm in on this. We'll start sort this all out. So he put his money in it. And there's a place in Romford near called the Willow Rooms. It's actually where I did my wedding reception, just round the corner from the betting shop. The Willow Rooms. It was owned by Les Carey as well, the Willow Rooms. And he had a meeting. He said, right, these are the numbered windows. We've numbered all the windows at Dagenham. He's got 40 market workers there. He gave them all loads of copper coins and shillings and pence. And he said, right, you go round these windows and do traps 1 and 6 reverse. Keep doing 1 and 6 reverse for 2 shillings reverse, 2 shillings reverse. Just keep doing them. And you've got somebody behind you. Don't let anybody else get in the window. We're going to keep doing 1 and 6 reverse. Then just before the off, John Turner, who was instigated it all, had a 2, 3, 4, 5, 24 shilling combination. Well, he'd managed to get £1,500 on 1 and 6 reversed. And so when the combination came out, I think 4 beat 2, if I can remember rightly, or 2 beat 4, something like that. Obviously, the whole pool, less their deductions, the dividend for a 7 of 4 chance to beat an 11 of 4 chance, you come to £1,093 or £43, well over £1,000. Well, during that day, the staff had been all round England putting on 2, 3, 4, 5 combinations for 24 shillings, 2, 3, 4, in all the betting shops right the way through the country. And we'd got it on for plenty and plenty of money. Like, I mean, my whack alone was going to come to £5,000 out of it all. You had to have it 5 times, didn't you? And, like, you know what I mean, got 5 grand. Well, they couldn't pay, could they? The answer was the betting shops could not pay. So it went to court, and they said that there was collusion, and I don't know, what's collusion about it? Just because nobody else could get on. And so none of us got paid, but that was the Dagenham Dog Coup organised by us.
Right, back in the day, Barry, when you were trying to get on course, I mean, you wouldn't live long enough to get a pitch at Cheltenham, etc. The dead man's shoe system must have been very frustrating for you.
Extremely frustrating. Remember, I got mainly silver rings for the first 2 or 3 years, but Lingfield for one, they amalgamated, made it all one ring. Lots of tracks started leaving out silver rings and just one ring. Well, all weather started, and the regular bookmakers in the winter, they called it the kipper season, didn't they? The regular bookmakers went off to the Bahamas or somewhere. They didn't need to go to these meetings in January, February, March. So when the all weather season started, I think I had a Lingfield pick number 36. Well, that got me nowhere near the front line. But on some occasions during this all-weather season that started, on really bad days, sleet, frost, snow, perhaps only 10 bookmakers turned up. So I got a much better pick because I was probably in pick number 10 by then. Well, there was one particular day, only 6 bookmakers turned up. And I was in pick number 6. Well, that's heaven for me. I've never been as close as that to the front row ever. But as the meeting progressed and the weather got worse and worse and worse, they all started dropping out, even the other bookmakers. So come the last race, I was in pick number 1. They'd all gone home. And the SP reporters all clustering around my ball because I've got to send a show out to all the betting shops. But I couldn't get any prices on the ball because it was the old chalk. The rain kept washing them all off. So the SP reporters came up and said, what was you going to put up, Barry? So I got hold of my lump of paper and said I was going to put up 1 at 7 of 4. They couldn't get any prices on the ball. So after that, when I come home, I thought, this is madness. I stand out the back there in all this weather. And then on Saturday, when the sun shines, they're all going to be back. I'll be back in pick number 36. So I went to management. I said, I pay 5 times the admission. The admission to get in here is about £2. I pay £10. I'll give you £100 to go in trap number 1. I said, cool, will you? I said, yeah, I'll pay £100 just to bet in number 1 instead of a tenner. And that caused a furore, didn't it? And I said, what's going on? They've got these pitches forever. They don't want to use them. I've got to get up the front to make any living. So it took a bit of time, but within inside a year or so, the BPA, and well, everybody knows like that, you had to be a geriatric to be on the board of the BPA, and they all had their vested interests in what happened on course, didn't they? So that was a boo-hooed, but suddenly they come around to the idea, well, they've been working there for 40 or 50 years, they're getting into their 70s, if somebody's going to pay them a few grand for the pitch and they could retire, that would be a good idea. So suddenly they changed their minds. Yeah, come on, we'll have a meeting and we'll sell all these pitches. And lo and behold, after a few years, there was an auction at Sandown and all the old timers wanted to get out and take some good money, 100, 200,000, went out of the game and they were pleased to do it. So we changed it after 4 or 5 years. That is now no longer dead men's shoes. You couldn't pass them on. You could sell them though.
When you suddenly got onto those pitches, when you bought up, were they as you imagined to be when you were looking from the back row?
Well, when it came round to the day of the sale, it was a Sunday, and as many people knew, one of my friends that lived locally were David Johnson, the big horse owner of Jumps Horse Race, owner of them days. And I said to him, I'd love to buy pitches, I said, but I can't afford them. He says, Bill, I'll lend you the money. I'll back you. I said, all right, David. I said, but what's the interest? He said, tell you what we'll do. You go and buy whatever you want. Whatever it comes to, I'll pay, and we'll shake hands whatever interest rate you want to pay. Well, it couldn't be fairer than that, could you? Like, you know what I mean? It's a fantastic deal. So I went along and spent £250,000 of his money buying pitches, didn't I? So I came home. I said to Marion like that night. She said, what happened? I said, I bought some pitches. She said, how much to spend? I said, £250,000. She fainted, didn't she? Like, and I said, where are we going to pay that back from? I said, don't worry, I'll win it. Now I've got these pitches, I will win it.
So when you got in them, did you suddenly think, oh, I can win this easier? Did you realise it maybe?
When I got into the pitches, I thought, this is like finding money in the street. Absolutely unbelievable. Remember in the older days, Fred Binns had pick number 1 everywhere. He never ever held any money. He hedged with the second row. The second row hedged with the third row. And so he was up for none and could only win. Well, I had never had any idea. I was never going to do that. I just couldn't stop taking money. I was turning over $2 million a year in the back rows. The day I went into the front rows, I was turning over $15 million a year. That's how much it jumped. And betting to 10% better than I was in the back rows. So I'd say it was a gold mine.
You became very famous, Barry, in the racing game. We'll talk about that a bit later on with Channel 4, but I remember being a floor man in the ring, was almost too scared to ask you for a bet because we get shouted at. You've always had a very strong character. Has that helped you or hindered you?
Well, I don't know. All I know is that's me, that's how I am. I want to be in charge. I wanted to be the top Johnny. I wanted to be there and everybody come to me. So I thought, make a lot of noise. Remember this, I was a street trader, wasn't I, in the early days, 9, 10 and 11, and you had to make yourself vocal. So that's what I wanted to do when I was on the race courses. Anybody come near, and I don't want people messing me about, like I don't come up and spend time. Have a bet, call it, pay the money and get going. Let's move on to the next person. I haven't got time to muck about.
Now, when I was working with bookmakers, I remember being quite near you and you really taking the mickey out of your punters, saying if you nick that out your mum's purse and stuff like that. Did that ever... that sort of banter ever backfire?
Yeah, it did on occasions, but I love the banter, I love the repartee, I love having a go, and I don't mind when they pop me back at all, but sometimes people said, you're the rudest bookmaker I've ever known on course. I told them, I said, listen, love, go round the back of the stands, go up, there's an office there, go and knock on the office door and complain about me, but you'll have to wait a long time because there's a big queue of people there waiting to complain about me, but have a bet or go away, I'm in a hurry, okay?
Now you mentioned about the ladies. I do remember you saying that they were a nuisance bet when you were at Royal Ascot. Oh. The place is heaving with them. Was that tongue-in-cheek or did you really mean
no,
it?
No, that's not tongue. That's unbelievable. Let me give you some stats on this. Horse racing runs about every 40, 45 minutes at Royal Ascot, doesn't it? There's a £50,000 crowd. £50,000, 50,000 people crowd, right? Of those 50,000, 30,000 of the women dressed up in fine frocks that cost them 200 quid, hats that cost them 200 quid, handbag that cost them £100, pair of ones and twos that cost them another £200, and they come up with a race card and they stand there and they want a pound each way, Frankie Dettori or somebody like that. Well, that transaction is going to take probably 30 seconds just to get rid of them, like, you know what I mean? By the way, they never have £2 ready. They've always got a £20 note as part of the game. Like, you've got to give them 18 shillings change as well. So what happened was that I said, I can't cope with this because I can't take enough money between races to make warrant a profit. So I put up a sign on top of the board, no women. Well, actually done me a favour because Claude Duval of the Sun come past, took a photo of it and put it in the Sun on the next page. And the Ascot authorities didn't take too kindly to it either. They made me take it down. But you cannot work with ladies. I love you. I think you're the best ladies in the world. Everybody has a bet at the races. But I'll tell you, give you an example. Douglas Erskine Scrum, Douglas Erskine, anyway, he came to me one day and said, how's the turnover in the ring? I said, fine now. He said, it's difficult on the tote. I said, of course it is, because you've got women working behind the tote bars, serving women, and they come up and then they say, can I please have 2 shillings place on horse, what horse shall I back? Numbers, and they turn to their friends and say, mate, what horse are we going to back for 2 shillings a place? And then when they give the 2 shillings over, and they give them a £10 note, and they say to the woman behind the ramp, they said, what do you think about the price of Dazzies today? Like, I mean, it's quite dear, isn't it? They have a 5-hour conversation. He couldn't take any money, so he put the minimum stake up to £5 just because of what I told him.
For over a decade, you got to say stuff like this on the telly, on Channel 4, and you were liked and possibly disliked in equal measure by people listening to it. How did the Channel 4 and the writing in the Sun come about?
Well, the Sun came about because of that when Claude Duval took the picture of me, and then the Channel 4 saw the picture and went to me in the studio one day. And so wherever they had always... at a prompt impromptu studio near the racetrack, wherever it was, okay. And the day they called me in was Ascot, and John Frankham laughed, and they all said, you can't do this to your customers, like, you know, you won't have any customers left. And said, well, if they're the customers I've got to have, I don't want any left, okay, I'll go without them, thanks very much. So they said, well, bookmakers, I think McCrick started this one, bookmakers always have a horse they want to lay every day, that's how they make their money, what do you want to lay? Well, I hadn't even looked, so I said, yeah, the first favourite that can't possibly win. I said, got no chance. If it starts now, it can't win. And luck would have it, like, it went from 11-8 to 7-4, and that got beat. So about two Saturdays later, the racing was abandoned everywhere in the country apart from Lingfield All Weather. And so Channel 4 had for the first time ever go to Lingfield All Weather and do the afternoon racing. So they rang me up on the Friday night and said, Barry, would you come into the studio tomorrow? Lingfield, I said, yeah, what's that about? They said, well, we'd like you to have you on TV because this is your track, Lingfield. You always attend it and be interesting. So they said, fine. So I put the phone. I said, oh, by the way, we want you to name a loser as well tomorrow, and we're going to call it Barry's Bismarck. I says, where'd you get that from? He says, oh, Alistair Dan made the word up because Bismarck should never get sunk or something. And so I said, oh, okay, all right. So I said, what time will I be there? I said, 8 o'clock. So I turn up at Lingfield, 8 o'clock, go on the panel and sit there and say, so-and-so, this can't win today, whatever. All of a sudden, decided to be the Bismarck. And they said, can you give us some tips on other races as well? I went, well, I'm really, all right, I'm not into tips. And so they wanted five tips. There's only six races. They wanted five tips. Well, can you believe, Simon? Four of the tips won, and the Bismarck got beat like it. I mean, well, went out. I was walking on clouds when I went away that night, and just, I thought that was the end of it. Well, the following week, they said, now we've given the job to John McCrick to name the loser. So he straight away put up an even money chance that won 15 lengths, didn't it? So the next Saturday, they said, it wasn't very good last week, John. What is your tip this week? So he put up a 6-4 chance that won 20 lengths, didn't it? Like, you know what I mean? So next week I get a phone call, Barry, please come back. Like, you know, we're getting slaughtered here. So I went back giving Bismarcks on the programme every Saturday morning. And once again, listen, it's all about fortune, isn't it, Simon, what happens in life. And I gave 10 consecutive losers on the spin every Saturday morning. And that was it. They wanted me permanently then, didn't they?
So, be honest with us, was that the result of serious hours studying the form, or was it a guess-up?
Serious hours studying form? I've never studied form in my life. I went down the programme, and the first time I saw an even money chance on the list, I'll have that one, that'll do that. Listen, I don't study form.
You mentioned Ascot, Barry, and I did ask you previously if you were there when Frankie Dettori did his Magnificent Seven, and you replied that you were. Can you, everybody likes to hear a bad story about bookmakers. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, I was on that particular day. After three or four, I wasn't even aware that Frankie Dettori had ridden the first three or four winners. Do you know that? I'd probably lost on a few of them, not particularly. There was nothing sensational about the day at all. Then after the sixth race, suddenly there was a buzz going on all around Ascot. And I said, listen, little stupid man. I said, what's the buzz? I said, Dettori's ridden the first six winners. I said, oh, was he called blimey? Okay, this will be short then, wasn't it? This next one, which was in the lunchtime, it has been 10-1. It was a big handicap. I can't remember how many runners, but plenty of runners. It was a 10-1 chance in the early betting. So some people put up 5-1 and got slaughtered. And I thought, they're mad taking this sort of price about this. Oh, I'll put up 5-2. Bosh, 2,500 to 1, Barry, 2,500 to 1. Officers coming in asking for 2,500 to 1. Also, it was 10-1. 3 or 4 hours before, they must be off their conkers. They must be mad. Who'd want to take 5-2 something that was 10-1 2 or 3 hours earlier? Took it out, 9-4, 9-4, 9-4. They just kept hitting me all the time. My poor son, Patrick, who used to work with me on Saturdays, he used to get 50 quid a day for working for me. That was too much money, but because it's my son, I paid him that much. So he said, Dad, can I take £200 out of this? He says, yeah, of course you can, son. You've laid a 500 or two as well. Yeah, I'll be pleased to pay you. Yeah, pleased to pay you. I stood there watching the race. He was in front about a mile out. And I thought, that's good, because he's got to get beat now, because once you hit the front a mile out, like, you know, you can't hang on, can you? Even Frankie Dettori can't do that. So it came to the bend, turning in 3 or 4 furlongs, and he was still in front. And my eyes, I went into a trance. I was looking up at the sky, at the clouds going past, thinking, am I hearing this right? Frankie Dettori, still in front, still in front, still in front. I was transfixed. For the last 100 yards, I couldn't move. I think it was Doug Smith or somebody come up, challenged it and never went through with it. And he hung on and won half a length. £27,000 I'd just done. 27. I'd never earned that before in a God knows how long, and now I've got that. So how am I going to get out of this? I don't know. We all drove home in silence. Not a word was said in the car. Nobody dared talk. I dropped them off. Got home to my house here, and went in through the front door, and Marion says, "Oh, hello, darling, did you have a good day?" I said, "Frankie Dettori rode 7 winners." She said, "Oh, marvellous," she said. I said, "Yeah, thanks very much." I went and sat down and got the scotch bottle out. I was drinking it by the neck, wasn't I? But I'd had a retirement pension thing going for years and years, been paying it for 30 years probably. It wasn't a hell of a lot of money every week, but I had to cash that in, lose all my pension funds all in one go. I think I got my money back after 30 years of what I'd paid in just to pay off all the debts, but we paid them, but that was the worst day. And the drive home in silence and getting indoors, killing, don't ever do it.
Now, not everybody likes to hear about bookmakers losing. I like to hear about them winning. So can you tell us about any memorable good days?
Well, I was never one to... I believed in let the money come to you. Don't force it. Don't ever force anything. Let it come to you and play the game. As you do in betting shops, you can't force it in betting shops. It makes no difference. You couldn't in them days. You just had to accept what people come up to the counter and had a bet. And so I used to work on that system. Remember, we was always working the big margins. And so I was happy to lay any sort of bet at the price that was on the board. Well, it was the first race at Cheltenham. I don't know if it was the first day or before the first race. I beg your pardon, it wasn't the first race. Before the first race, Big Mac came over and said, "Barry, we're going to come over and interview you, like, you know what I mean, about the day's business." He said, "We're going to go on to the... there's a 3-mile race in which JP McManus had a runner. I think it was called Barracuda. Very good horse." And so it'd been 5-4 everywhere in the morning. And never better. 11% 5-4. So I said, "Right, I'm going to make this my Bismarck, guys. And I'm going to put 11-8 on the board. All the people cluster around whenever McCrurick comes with the cameras. They're all there wanting to wave and God knows what. And we'll take a nice few quid out. Be a good profile to take, lay this at 11-8. So I put up 11-8, 20 quid, 40 quids, and 10 quids, 60 quids. And so Big Mouth McCrurick said, "Well, go on, go 6-4, Dennis." And so, yeah, 6-4 I've held. JP McManus's head popped up. He said, £40,000, Barry. And now I've got a big crowd listening, and I said, "Yes, John, £40,000, £60,000 to £40,000, thank you. But I've got to be bold, I can't be frightened," so I left it on the board. He said, "Oh, was that enough, Barry?" I said, "No, no, you've got another 20, £60,000. He said, "Okay, fine, if that's what you want to lay." I said, "John, you've got £80,000 at 6-4, £120,000 to £80,000. He said, "Thank you very much, Barry," and walked away. Well, the whole ring's alive now. They've all heard him of 80,000 quid at 6-4. It's 11 to 10 in places all the way around now. And McCrick's gone away, spread it on television. Barry Dennis just laid 6-4 to £80,000. JP, thanks very much indeed, John. So now I've got to sit and sweat it out. Well, the top men keep getting bets sent over from the small ring to lay. And it'd gone back to 5-4, 11-8. So I went to the top man. I said, "Any 6-4, I'm in it. Don't even worry about it. Just return it. I will back it at 6-4 to any amount of money." I was lucky enough to get about 15 grand on the thing at 6-4. So there it is. I've got it stuck up my nuts for about £100,000, don't I? Something like that. Well, it came down the hill, 2 lengths in front of a horse. Remember, I told you I'm old, I can't remember the names of these horses. You lot will look it up and remember which one it was. And they were a distance clear. And the horse in second place was being flogged to death. I thought, oh my God, here we go. Like, I mean, put your bicycle clips on, Barry, because the diarrhea was running down my legs, wasn't it? Like, you know what I mean? Anyway, so what happened? God was a bookmaker. This horse that was in second place, look it up, all you lot, you'll remember it, come and done it on the line, Barracuda, didn't it? And so there it was. I finished up winning over 60 grand on that race. JP come back the next race and had a 90,000 or 20-something that didn't particularly shorten up, but it got beat. And he gave me a cheque for 100 grand on the day, and that's what I won on the day.
Now, Barry, obviously you're a racing man through and through, but not necessarily through and through. I understand you're also a big fan of other sports and travel around to follow it.
Certainly do, Simon. I love cricket. Listen, this is what cricket does to me. My wife is one of those sun worshippers. I can't lay on the beach at all. But when we go in all over the world, whether it be the West Indies, South Africa, Australia, India, Sri Lanka, every test match in the world, test match places, I've been there and taken the wife, Australia two or three times. And I leave her behind in the hotel. She loves the sunbathing. I go off to cricket. And the best thing about the Australian is I go and sit in, don't sit in the Barmy Army. I sit in amongst the Australians so I can wind them up and give them some stick, like, you know what I mean? Plenty of times I get stick, but it's good fun sitting in amongst them, giving them some.
Never felt like taking a few bets off them?
Yeah, oh, well, I'd love to take a few bets off them, but they're so stingy, the Australians. I don't know if they'd pay, like, you know what I mean?
Right, Barry, you've already mentioned that you've never really been a form student, so has punting ever played a part in your career?
No way. I couldn't have a bet. I couldn't have £100 on a horse to save my life. I'd stand up for thousands, but I could not back horse. Backing horses is for mugs. I don't want to back horses, so just, it's not in me, like, you know what I mean? But sometimes I have a lean in a race, when I'm betting on a race, if certain faces... Listen, this is how strange it can be. I could be standing there laying 100, 200, 400, 1,000 pound bets to favourites, second favourites, and in comes a face and has a 70 pound of 20, the third in, and straight away that comes off and goes 3-1. That's 70 pound of 20 from this particular, these, whoever they may be, it's not always the same face, means more to me than all the 400 and 1,000 pound bets.
So got, sit on a similar line, would you ever listen to any somebody coming whispering in your ear, this one's not off today, would that affect you at all?
It depends, I suppose sometimes it affects me, but I get so many of them every day, like, you know what I mean? Every day people are trying to, why do they want to buzz you up? Is it for an ego or something? They want to buzz you something up, or they think they're right, or they're trying to help you, but generally I don't take any notice of them, but as I said, there are certain people I respect, and so I... do hold back on those horses.
It's interesting you mentioned people that you respect. That's one of my questions for later, but we'll ask that one now. Have there been any particular punters, bookmakers, whatever, that you've respected or, dare I say, disliked along the way, that, and for any particular reason?
I'm not sure, Simon, how you mean. Any ones I disliked. Any punter that wins, I dislike, you know what I mean? But I like them if they lose the next race, so I don't know about dislike particularly. Listen, Simon... there's punters that won't bet with me because they dislike me. I understand that. They walk past me to take the same price with other bookmakers. And that's up to them, entirely. But I have little wars with certain people all the time. But it's part of my profile.
Well, shall I rephrase? Any punters that, if you saw them coming for, oh, no, I hope he gives me the swerve because they were a bit clever?
No punters who I particularly wanted the swerve. There's some punters around that, I say to the clerk, are all our prices tight enough? Because I see a punter coming and I don't want to be over the odds and lay him over the odds unnecessarily if I happen to be above the price, you know what I mean, than anybody else.
You're talking about checking on prices. I mean, there was a massive thing that affected the betting ring when people started using Betfair. I mean, what were your opinions on it when it first sort of appeared on the racecourse?
Well, I was the one that took the biggest advantage in the early days. Much to my mistake, like, you know what I mean, that Betfair was offering 5-1 and you could lay 4-1 on course, and it caused me to get involved with Betfair, but it's the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. The whole of the racing industry, the whole of it, all racing, has now been slaughtered by Betfair being around and Betfair markets.
So you definitely think that if it was it could ever be turned around? Is it possible to turn it around now?
Well, I don't know if the government can make any changes to the rules. When they let all the betting go offshore and Betfair and the punters were getting away with taking these offshore prices, and so none of the liquidity was kept in this country, that's when it all went by side. Nowadays, Simon, of the on-course books, if there could be a check-up after each race, how much had been fielded and how much had been hedged to betting exchanges, you'd find that there's more turnover been hedged to betting exchanges than been kept by the bookmakers in the ring.
Right, Barry, you've already told us that you've been a bookmaker in pretty much since you were a child. So what is it about the game that you love and being a bookmaker?
I just love the buzz, honestly. It gives me a buzz. Every day, even now, if I get up and I'm going racing, I go there with the excitement that I'm likely to win money and play people and win or lose, but it's just an absolute buzz to me.
So what do you think makes a good bookmaker?
A good bookmaker is one that has a rapport with the punters, that takes decent bets, that gives them a good service, and pays with a smile, which is not one that Barry Dickens is known to do, pay with a smile, but still, you got to give the punters a good service.
Now, going back to Channel 4 days, you were probably, well, you were the best-known racecourse bookmaker in the country for about, well, at least a decade. Did you ever have any drawbacks to that? People recognise you in the street or that sort
of thing? Listen, it's all part of the game. They come out and want selfies all the time. They come out and want to talk to me. Women want to kiss me. That's the worst thing, Simon. Women want to kiss me. But that's all part of that. I'll tell you a story. I was on holiday in Italy somewhere, Sorrento or something, and we got on a bus because we wanted to go somewhere, and suddenly, as I sat down, the bloke in the bus in Italy, in Sorrento, says, Barry Bismarck! I said, oh, sorry, mate. Like, you know what I mean? So somebody in Italy, in Sorrento, recognised me.
We've talked about the negative impact Betfair's had on the betting ring. Do you think there's anything the bookmakers could do to try and turn things around and to encourage more people back into bet with them nowadays?
Well, I don't know about into bet with us, because the way the bookmakers are betting, as everybody knows, the prices the bookmakers put up are slightly under the exchange prices. That's how it all works now, right across the board. There's no fluctuation of prices anymore. People complain about that most of all. They go down, we're all the same price. Once upon a time when it was chalk and duster, there'd be lots of different prices around and you go and swerve around and try and get the best price. But now they're all governed. In fact, prices change on some boards with the exchanges. It does it automatically. They just change the price on the board. So that can't help, but I don't know about bringing midweek crowds. It's a dear, isn't it? A day out racing is so dear. If you think they're charging the 20 quid to get in and two of you go and have a bit of lunch or something like that and the transport and whatever and have a few bets, you can do a bottle, 200 quid, can't you? Well, that's a dear day out.
Now, if a young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed 20-year-old Barry Dennis came up to you now looking for advice, I want to start as a racecourse bookmaker, would you still give your young self the advice to do it in today's climate?
Definitely no. There's no way. Simon, the turnover isn't there anymore. Remember what I said, that originally when I was working in the back rows, I was turning over 2 million a year. That went up to 15 million a year when I was in the front rows. Now, I was turning over the equivalent of £50,000-£60,000 a day midweek during the early days. When we got round to Royal Ascot's or Cheltenham's, and that, my turnover was £200,000 on the day. Nowadays, I turn over 10 grand a day. That's in good days. The game's gone.
Okay, Barry. Well, this is probably going to seem like a bit of a daft question after what you've just said, but is there a future for on-course bookmaking, in your opinion?
Yes. There is those that want to treat it as a job where they earn average-type monies, i.e., as a bookmaker, I won't name him, but he said to me, Barry, I go out with my wife, and so they've got no expenses. Okay, that seems common nowadays, isn't it, Simon? People use their family. He said, I go out 6 days a week and earn £100 a day. That's £600 a week. Now, do you want to go and sweep roads or dig ditches for £600 a week? What a wonderful life, going to work and earning £600 a week. That is the future if that's what you want to do.
I would imagine you would agree you had the last of the good days of the betting ring. Have you sort of lived the dream?
Oh, I'd lived the dream then. It was partying from all day, every day. Stop on the way home and have 10 bottles of champagne. And it was just living the dream, all those periods. I had a few years, I say, when I was, you can imagine, earning big bananas when I was turning over 15 million a year. And all the staff enjoyed it. Everybody, big holidays. I used to fly from track to track in helicopters and all the time, just for the fact of getting to another track where I could turn money over.
So is there, as a footnote then, is there anything that you've done in your career that you would have changed?
Nothing at all. Never, ever would I change anything. I do things on the spur of the moment, but I accept them and live with it, and it's either right or wrong. I make it right, and that's the way I want it to be.
Starsports.bet provide the complete betting experience. Find us online via our website and app, on course, and at our flagship betting shop in London's Mayfair. 18 years and older only. BeGambleAware.org.